Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day.
The Surprising Link Between Marriage and Heart Health by Amanda McMillan. People in marriages that steadily get sweeter have lower cholesterol and healthier weight than marriages that stay the same, according to a new 16-year study. But both were preferable to a marriage that got worse. Couples in them were more likely to develop high blood pressure later in life. The study, published in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health, isn't the first to suggest a link between marital quality and heart health. But most research has only looked at relationship satisfaction at one point in time, which makes it tough to determine whether marriage really has a protective effect on health, or if healthier people simply tend to be in happier marriages. The new research measured marital ups and downs over the years to see if they went along with changes in heart health. To do so, researchers analyzed data from a long-running study of parents and children in Britain in which fathers were surveyed about their marriage quality when their children were about 3 and again at about age 9. More than 2,000 people completed the survey once at the start of the study and again 6 years later, and 620 completed a follow-up analysis about a decade after the study's start. At the time, the men had their blood pressure, resting heart rate, body mass index, cholesterol, and fasting glucose levels measured, all of which indicate heart disease risk factors. Interestingly, there was very little difference in cardiovascular risk profiles between men who had consistently good relationships than those who had consistently bad ones during the study. But after adjusting for several influencing factors, including age, education, height, and household income, the researchers noticed a small but distinct patterns for men whose marriages had either improved or deteriorated during that time. Men who said their marriage got better over the years had lower LDL, or bad cholesterol, and healthier weights, about one BMI unit less at the end of the study, compared to those whose relationship satisfaction was consistently good for those years. Meanwhile, those whose relationships got worse ended up with blood pressure an average of 2.7 points higher than those with consistently good marriages. The researchers write in the paper that it makes sense that changes in marital quality could trigger these types of changes in cardiovascular health, and that they may not become obvious until after a latency period of several years. The fact that people in consistently good marriages fared no better than those in bad ones is contradictory to other research. But the researchers say their data about marital quality over time may paint a more complete picture. People in unchanging relationships may become habituated to their circumstances, the authors hypothesize, which may keep them from benefiting as much as those in relationships that steadily improve. The study, however, can't draw cause and effect conclusions. The authors point out that a large number of people dropped out before the final measurements were taken, and that those who remained were more likely to report better marriage quality and fewer health and financial problems. Because the people in the study are still relatively young, it's also unclear whether more risk factors will actually lead to more heart disease. The researchers also don't know if their findings would apply to women. But in the paper, they refer to a 2014 study in which worsening relationships were linked to worsening cardiovascular health more strongly for wives than for husbands. Men may be less likely to internalize a poor relationship than women, the authors of the study speculated. There are still a lot of unknowns about the link between marital quality and heart health. But in their paper, the authors raise the possibility that working to improve the former may help improve the latter. Further research needs to determine if effective marriage counseling or, when appropriate, abandoning a deteriorating relationship has longer-term physical health benefits over and above psychological well-being, they write. Deadly California wildfires force thousands to evacuate. By Jeff Chu and Ellen Nickmeyer. An onslaught of wildfires across a wide swath of Northern California broke out almost simultaneously, then grew exponentially, swallowing up properties from wineries to trailer parks and tearing through both tiny rural towns and urban subdivisions. At least 10 were dead, at least 100 injured, and at least 1,500 homes and businesses have been destroyed, authorities said. All three figures were expected to surge in the coming days as more information is reported. Taken as a group, the fires are already among the deadliest in California history. Residents who gathered at emergency shelters and grocery stores said they were shocked by the speed and the ferocity of the flames. They recalled all the possessions they had left behind and were lost. "All that good stuff, I'm never going to see it again," said Jeff Okrepi, who fled his neighborhood in Santa Rosa, knowing it was probably the last time he would see his home of the past 5 years standing. His worst fears were confirmed Monday, when a friend sent him a photo of what was left, a smoldering heap of burnt metal and debris. Some of the largest of the 14 blazes burning over a 200-mile region were in Napa and Sonoma counties, home to dozens of wineries that attract tourists from around the world. They sent smoke as far south as San Francisco, about 60 miles away. Sonoma County said it has received more than 100 missing person reports as family and friends scramble to locate loved ones. The reports have come via calls to a hotline the county set up for the missing, according to Scott Alonzo, communications director for Sonoma County. It's possible that many or most of the missing are safe, but simply can't be reached because of the widespread loss of cell service and other communications. Much of the damage was in Santa Rosa, a far larger and more developed city than usually finds itself at the mercy of a wildfire. The city is home to 175,000 residents, including both the wine country wealthy and the working class. The flames were unforgiving to both groups. Hundreds of homes of all sizes were leveled by flames so hot they melted the glass off of cars and turned aluminum wheels into liquid. Former San Francisco Giants pitcher Noah Lowry, who now runs an outdoor sporting goods store in Santa Rosa, was forced to flee in minutes along with his wife, two daughters, and a son, just over 2 weeks old. "I can't shake hearing people scream in terror as the flames barreled down on us," Lowry said. His family, and another evacuating with them, tried to take US 101 to evacuate, but found it blocked by flames, and had to take country roads to get to the family friends who took them in. A 90-mile stretch of the highway is framed by flames and a major concern overnight, said Brad Alexander, a spokesman for the California Office of Emergency Services. Highway 12, which winds its way through the heart of wine country, was also rendered unusable by the flames. Sonoma and Napa counties have been hit very hard, Alexander said. The ferocity of the flames forced authorities to focus primarily on getting people out safely, even if it meant abandoning structures to the fire. Firefighters rushed to a state home for the severely disabled when flames reached one side of the center's sprawling campus in the historic Sonoma County town of Glen Ellen. Crews got more than 200 people from the threatened buildings, one firefighter said, as flames closed within a few dozen feet. Fires from ruptured gas lines dotted the smoky landscape of blackened Santa Rosa hillsides. Fire trucks raced by smoldering roadside landscaping in search of higher priorities. The flames were fickle in some corners of the city. One hillside home remained unscathed, while a dozen surrounding it were destroyed. Kim Ho, a 33-year-old tech worker from Penang, Malaysia, was staying at the Hilton Sonoma Wine Country, which was gutted by flames. He said the power went out around 1 a.m., and he and his colleagues started packing up when someone knocked on the door and told them to run. "We just had to run and run. It was full of smoke. We could barely breathe," Ho said. The large majority of the injured were treated for smoke inhalation, according to St. Joseph Health, which operates hospitals in the Santa Rosa area. Two were in critical condition, and one was in serious condition. The number of injured is expected to climb as information comes in from other areas affected by the firestorm consuming the state. October has generally been the most destructive time of the year for California wildfires. What was unusual Sunday, however, was to have so many fires take off at the same time. Other than windy conditions that helped drive them all, there was no known connection between the fires, and no cause has been released for any of them. But the conditions late Monday and early Tuesday were calmer than they were 24 hours earlier, bringing hopes of progress against the flames. Governor Jerry Brown declared a state of emergency for the fire areas and asked the federal government to do the same. Vice President Mike Pence, who is visiting California, said at an event near Sacramento that the federal government stands with California as it takes on the blazes, but he made no specific promises. To the south in Orange County, more than 5,000 homes were evacuated because of a fire in the Anaheim area. The blaze had grown to nearly 10 square miles and had destroyed 24 structures.
Rachel Platten is more than just fight song. The pop singer on her brave new sound, Barisa Brunner. You've probably heard Rachel Platten's voice before. Her empowering pop song Fight Song was picked up as the unofficial theme to Hillary Clinton's ill-fated presidential campaign. But as singer-songwriter Platten, who won an Emmy for a Good Morning America performance last year, tells Time, there's much more to her than just one big anthem. It's amazing that that song had such an impact, but I'm a songwriter and an artist, and I had a career for a long time, and I'm going to have a career for a long time, Platten says. I feel like I opened that door with Fight Song, and that's beautiful, and there's no way I'm going to let it close. Her late summer single, Broken Glass, follows in the mold of her first hit. But it's just one note in a broader story, Platten says, one she's been writing for a while, and that will come to light in her new album, Waves, out October 27th. Second single, Perfect for You, came out Friday. Writing is my first passion, she explains. It's the way that I understand the world. It's the way that I process what I'm seeing around me, and it's the legacy I want to leave. Here, she discusses her search for more emotionally resonant pop, her approach to creativity, and how social media can be an artist's downfall. Time asks, what's the broken glass story? Platten. It was a pretty inspiring year to be a woman, and also devastating. It was at the Women's March. It was so beautiful to see women standing up for each other in a world where we're often encouraged to compete with one another. I know I do, too. I'll look around and get jealous of people who have things I don't have. I'm working on it. But I feel like this year encouraged us to recognize that when we're standing up for each other, that's how we're unstoppable. That's how we break down walls. And also, I just wanted to make a song for my strong girlfriends and the amazing line of women that I come from. You mentioned the Women's March. Are you part of other communities that have inspired you this year or changed how you approach music? I started working with an organization called I Am That Girl this year. They have these meetings that are almost like AA meetings for young women. They're run by girls their own age, no adults in the room. You go around and you start every meeting saying, I'm a badass because, and everyone has to answer it. It flips the script running in your mind that is constantly telling you, I'm not good enough, and then it gets real. I went to a meeting in California and a girl talked about a suicide attempt. Another about abuse. It's a really powerful thing to see girls supporting each other. So that community totally continued my desire to help lift up women and encourage them to stand up for themselves. After Fight Song, did you consider going in a different direction with your music, or did you feel like it was a lane you needed to follow? You know what's funny? The rest of the record is not that lane at all. Broken Glass has the girl power. The other ones have tastes of it, because that is who I am sometimes. But I'm also someone who wakes up in the middle of the night fearful and needing to know that there's answers. I'm also someone who gets jealous of people. I'm also someone who just wants to party and bop and dance. So there are all those sides on the record. I did want, at least with the first single, to follow what I did with Fight Song. I was proud to have a platform this time because last time around, I had no idea if anyone was going to care. This has been a crazy year, and honestly, I've been excited that the past month there have been more artists releasing songs that feel like a response to it. In what way are you seeing artists making music that's a response? Pink's What About Us, Julia Michaels, even Kesha's Praying, they feel emotionally rich, not just songs about clubs and dancing. Those are awesome, too. They make me happy, and I work out to them, but I've been craving a little more from music. I've been looking for that. And Kendrick's new album. I feel like Kendrick's done the best so far. Do you see yourself fulfilling a certain role in pop? I want to bring a little more consciousness and light to the industry, and a little bit more sticking up for one another and supporting one another, artists coming together to help answer some of the questions we're all asking right now. What's changed most in the industry since you started off as a songwriter? It wasn't such a singles market before. It was about albums. Now I don't know that people know necessarily the artist connected to the song, so that's changed a lot. It's way more about the song than about the artist. I also think the way we have to keep up with social media as artists changes how we write and how we view ourselves. Before, you didn't have to be so focused on how you were perceived every minute. Our Instagram feeds have become highlight reels that are sometimes a lie. It's pretty exhausting. Honestly, it can be at the expense of your art. This year, I deleted all the social media from my phone while I was in the studio. I watched my numbers on social media drop because of it. That was scary, but I was like, that doesn't matter. My job right now is to create the realest, most true thing that I can. How would you describe the new album, your new sound? I think I was a lot braver. We broke a lot of rules. My main collaborators and I felt like we were little kids in a playground with no adults around to tell us what we can't do. If Wildfire was my feelings from like 5 to 10 on the scale, this is like 1 to 10. All the way from girl bop feeling good, roll your windows down, to crying in the middle of the night, wondering what the point is. What was the hardest part of putting together the album? All I needed to do was get myself out of the way and be open with the songs. Sometimes with creativity, you can't judge it too early. So this process, I just got myself out of the way as much as I could and didn't judge it, and just let whatever crazy sounds or crazy lyrics come through.
Harvey Weinstein has been fired from his company after sexual abuse allegations. By Jack Coyle for the Associated Press in New York. Harvey Weinstein, the sharp-elbowed movie producer whose combative reign in Hollywood made him an Academy Awards regular, was terminated from the Weinstein Company on Sunday following an exposé that detailed decades of sexual abuse allegations made against Weinstein by actresses and employees. In a statement, the company's board of directors announced his termination Sunday night, capping the swift downfall of one of Hollywood's most powerful producers and expelling him from the company he co-created. In light of new information about misconduct by Harvey Weinstein that has emerged in the past few days, the directors of the Weinstein Company, Robert Weinstein, Lance Marov, Richard Konigsberg, and Tarak Ben Amar, have determined and have informed Harvey Weinstein that his employment with the Weinstein Company is terminated effective immediately, the company's board said in a statement on Sunday night. Weinstein had previously voluntarily taken an indefinite leave of absence following the revelation of at least allegations of sexual harassment uncovered in an exposé Thursday by the New York Times. The board on Friday endorsed that decision and announced an investigation into the allegations, saying it would determine the co-chairman's future with the company. But the Weinstein Company board, which includes Weinstein's brother, went further on Sunday, firing the executive who has always been its primary operator, public face, and studio chief. Under his leadership, the Weinstein Company has been a dominant force at the Oscars, including the rare feat of winning back-to-back Best Picture Academy Awards with The King's Speech and The Artist. In recent years, however, Weinstein's status has diminished because of money shortages, disappointing box office returns, and executive departures. An attorney for Weinstein didn't immediately return messages Sunday. A spokesperson for the Weinstein Company declined to provide further details on Weinstein's firing. Messages left for attorney John Kiernan of the firm DeBevoss & Plimpton LLP, who had been appointed to lead an investigation, weren't immediately returned Sunday. Weinstein on Thursday issued a lengthy statement that acknowledged causing a lot of pain. He also asked for a second chance. But Weinstein and his lawyers also criticized the New York Times report in statements and interviews and vowed an aggressive response. "We are confident in the accuracy of our reporting," said a New York Times spokesperson in a statement. "Mr. Weinstein was aware and able to respond to specific allegations in our story before publication. In fact, we published his response in full." The New York Times article chronicled allegations against Weinstein from film star Ashley Judd and former employees at both the Weinstein Company and Weinstein's former company Miramax. Weinstein made his name with Miramax, the company he founded with his brother Bob in 1979. They sold it to Disney in 1993 for $60 million.
The company was a fixture of the 1990s independent film movement, launching the careers of filmmakers Quentin Tarantino, Kevin Smith, and Steven Soderbergh, and winning Best Picture with Shakespeare in Love and The English Patient. The allegations triggered cascading chaos at the Weinstein Company. Numerous members of its all-male board have stepped down since Thursday. The prominent attorney Lisa Bloom, daughter of well-known Los Angeles women's rights attorney Gloria Allred, on Saturday withdrew from representing Weinstein, as did another advisor, Lanny Davis.
Meet Kim Yo-jung, the sister at the center of North Korea's regime, by Eli Meixler. There's a new face in North Korea's top decision-making body. Kim Yo-jung, the youngest daughter of late leader Kim Jong-il and sister of current head of state Kim Jong-un, was named as a member to the Workers' Party's Politburo, the country's highest political assembly, at a central committee meeting on Saturday, the BBC reports. Kim Yo-jung, who replaced her aunt Kim Kyung-hui, a powerful ally of her father, was already a senior official as vice director of the isolated regime's propaganda and agitation department, PAD, according to North Korea Analysis Group 38 North. There is little concrete information about the key players of the isolated nation, but Kim Yo-jung, 30, is believed to be one of Kim Jong-un's closest aides and confidants. The two share a mother and reportedly lived together while studying at a boarding school in Bern, Switzerland. She is believed to be married to the son of powerful party secretary Cho Ryung-hae, and frequently appears alongside her brother at public events. She featured prominently at her father's funeral in 2011 and participated in the closely watched Seventh Party Congress, WPK, the first keynote assembly of party, political, and military officials held under Kim Jong-un, and after a 36-year hiatus. Kim Yo-jung was among seven North Korean officials targeted with U.S. sanctions in January 2017 for ongoing and serious human rights abuses and censorship activities. Kim Yo-jung's elevation has helped to solidify Kim Jong-un's position by further concentrating power within his inner circle and immediate family members, according to analysts at 38 North. Her promotion to the PAD's top post in 2015 was also interpreted by North Korea watchers as an effort to consolidate the young leader's power, South Korean outlet Daily NK reported at the time. Among her chief responsibilities at PAD were idolization projects that promoted the regime's personality cult. She is also thought to be responsible for Kim's public image. Saturday's reshuffle involved dozens of top officials, including the promotion of Kim Jong-sik and Ri Pyong-chol, two key figures in the country's missile program, and Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho was elevated to a full vote-holding position on the Politburo, Reuters reports. Last month, Ri Yong-ho called President Donald Trump President Evil in his address at the UN General Assembly and likened his threats to the sound of a dog barking, the latest in an escalating war of words that has seen Trump refer to Kim Jong-un as Little Rocket Man and threaten to totally destroy the reclusive state.
Nixon lawyer Donald Trump abused pardon power when he freed Joe Arpaio. By John W. Dean and Ron Fine. John W. Dean served as White House counsel to President Richard M. Nixon from 1970 to 1973. Ron Fine is the legal director of Free Speech for People, which filed an amicus brief in Arpaio's criminal case. During the last 2 days of his embattled presidency, Richard Nixon made a rare principled decision. With the Watergate special prosecutor and congressional impeachment proceedings closing in, he rejected last-minute requests for pardons from his two former top aides, the men who could most damagingly testify against him. Unfortunately, while dust is settling on Donald Trump's pardon of former Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio, its message suggests a much cruder view of the pardon power and sets a dangerous precedent for the months to come. Most pardons attract little attention. Over the course of a presidency, typical presidents, with the advice of the Department of Justice, pardon or commute the sentences of hundreds of people who have moved beyond their crimes and long after all investigations have ended. Sometimes presidents issue pardons to try to help the nation move past bitter divisions, such as Gerald Ford's pardon of Nixon and Jimmy Carter's general pardon of Vietnam draft dodgers. And occasionally, presidents issue pardons to friends, relatives, or supporters, and even at the request of a foreign government, such as Bill Clinton's controversial pardon of fugitive financier Mark Rich. But never has a president embroiled in scandal used the pardon power to protect himself. Nixon's refusal provides useful history. On March 1, 1974, a federal grand jury indicted former Chief of Staff H.R. Haldeman, former Chief Domestic Advisor John Ehrlichman, and five others for criminal conspiracy stemming from the Watergate cover-up. The president was exposed as well. To be sure, the Department of Justice took the position that a president cannot be indicted while in office, but the grand jury named Nixon as an unindicted co-conspirator. And before Ford pardoned him, he risked future prosecution. On August 7th, Haldeman and Ehrlichman, employing different channels, approached the White House and asked for pardons. They did not need to point out that the risk of prison time makes people more likely to testify. Yet Nixon rejected their request. The next day, he announced his resignation and submitted himself to fate. Gerald Ford later pardoned Nixon on September 8, 1974. Haldeman and Ehrlichman each served 18 months in prison. Neither ever fully testified under oath. Their accounts of the Watergate cover-up are found only in their White House recordings and Nixon's secret tapes. Later presidents have also declined to use the pardon power to protect themselves from scandal. George H.W. Bush, who may have faced some legal risk from the Reagan administration's Iran-Contra scandal, eventually pardoned several key figures, but long after anyone might have had an incentive to implicate him. Bill Clinton pardoned his former law partner, Susan McDougal, of charges stemming from the Whitewater deal, but only after she'd already been released from prison. Arpaio's pardon sent a signal that reverberated in Washington. For Trump's current and former associates embroiled in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russiagate investigation, the message is unmistakable. Don't cooperate, and I'll pardon you. First, the timing. Most presidents use clemency cautiously. Hot pardons, if addressed, tend to come towards the end of a president's final term. The fact that Trump is willing to pardon and praise a polarizing figure like Arpaio after just 7 months in office is telling. It indicates that he will not likely worry about political blowback from pardoning former subordinates who could implicate him in wrongdoing whenever he feels it's necessary. Second, the crime. Arpaio was convicted of contempt of court for disobeying a court order. The pardon signals to Trump's current and former aides that if they are threatened with contempt for refusing to testify, he will pardon them too. This president is not troubled by the separation of powers. Third, the motive. There are not many other options for Trump to convey that message to former aides, such as former campaign chairman Paul Manafort and former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who are in the special counsel's sights. If he tried to reassure them directly, it could constitute witness tampering or other obstruction of a criminal investigation in violation of federal law. In the Nixon impeachment proceedings, Congress specifically cited Nixon's various promises of executive clemency to induce various Watergate participants to plead guilty and refuse to testify. But one effective way to send the message that, if the heat gets too close, hold tight and I will pardon you, is to pardon someone else. Ideally, someone just as controversial. Someone like Arpaio. That gives the president plausible deniability. Manafort, Flynn, and other Trump associates understand the signal, but the president can deny that he encouraged them not to cooperate with law enforcement. The framers were aware of this danger. In the Virginia constitutional ratification debates, George Mason criticized the pardon power, arguing that the president may frequently pardon crimes which were advised by himself and so destroy the republic. James Madison replied that if there were grounds to believe that the president would use the pardon to shelter a person with whom he was connected in any suspicious manner, then Congress could impeach him. Federal courts can also restrain a president's abuse of the pardon power. To be sure, the Supreme Court has not held a presidential pardon invalid since 1915 and under different circumstances. But the justices have hinted from time to time that at least some clemency decisions might be open to challenge, and advocates are making solid legal arguments about why the Arpaio pardon crosses a constitutional line. Coming months will be critical. Mueller appears to be moving aggressively. Just ask Manafort and Flynn. He has advised the White House that he plans to interview 6 former and current aides. As the investigation closes in, the incentives for cooperation will increase, and so will the temptation for Trump to try to make it all go away. Before that happens, responsible members of Congress, the media, and public should make clear that abuse of the pardon power by Trump to impede Mueller's investigation will have the same consequences as firing the special counsel. Impeachment proceedings will commence immediately. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.